Welcome to the Good Glow podcast with Sarah Corbett Lynch. This season of the Good Glow is brought to you with thanks to Electrocell, a simple way to keep on top of your hydration. Not just for athletes, Electrocell is for anyone who wants an easy way to stay hydrated, whether you're at work, out for a walk, getting on with your day, and it can also be used to stay hydrated in hot weather. It's available in three flavors. There's always one that's perfect for you, with a mix of key electrolytes like sodium, potassium and magnesium. Find Electrocell at your local pharmacy or visit electrocell.ie for more. Electrocell is a food supplement and should not replace a balanced diet. Always read the label before use. Welcome to a very special episode of The Good Glow with Sarah. You know, this is a story that I have followed for years and I'm so grateful to Sarah for coming on to The Good Glow today to tell her story in full. So at 3:15 a.m. on the 2nd of August 2015, 8-year-old Sarah was lifted from her bed by a police officer and carried downstairs, shielded from the chaos that had broken out around her. Her brother Jack was 10. Hours later, Sarah learned that her dad Jason was dead, and the people who killed him were Sarah's stepmother Molly Martins and her father Tom. Jason was found beaten to death in his bedroom. It's a story that's gripped the nation for years, and today Sarah tells her story about her life in North Carolina with her dad and Molly, and the truth about what life was like behind closed doors. Molly first met Jason when she travelled to Ireland from Tennessee to become Jack and Sarah's au pair after their mum Mags died of an asthma attack when Sarah was just 12 weeks old. All these years later, Sarah refers to her dad's sister Tracy as her mom and her husband David as her earth dad. They have supported, cared and loved Sarah and Jack all their lives. This feels like maybe one of the most important podcasts that I've ever recorded. Welcome to The Good Glow. How are you?
I'm really happy to be here. It's been a while. We definitely have been planning this for a good long time, you know. And I've met you a few times at the Christmas shows, so I'm really excited to be here.
Your mum, Tracy, was telling me that that's become your Christmas tradition now, and I'm so happy to be a part of that with you guys. But yeah, like we said, this has been coming for a long time. I think not just for me, for the whole country.
Yeah, definitely.
To hear your story. And it's so beautifully written in your book, which is out this week, A Time for Truth. Can you tell me why you decided to write this book?
I remember the moment that I decided to write the book. I'd left the courtroom. I was having a panic attack in one of the stalls. And it was in that moment, it was frustration and anger, because we had been sitting in the courtroom for days at that stage and just heard untruths about my dad and my words twisted. And I never had a voice. I had seen podcasts and seen articles and documentaries made that didn't have my voice. And because of the gag order and because we didn't get to give evidence, I knew all I had in the courtroom was my victim impact statement, and that wasn't even the tip of the iceberg. So it was important for me to write it down and to share my story.
And I think for everybody in Ireland, we have been following this story for so many years. And like I always say to people when they come onto this podcast, this isn't just a story for a podcast. This is your real life and something that you have had to live through for so many years. I have to say, when I read the book, there's so much that I didn't know. I thought, because I've been following this story for so many years, that I knew the ins and outs and everything about it. But wow, there's just so much in this book that just, first of all, made me so emotional. Can you tell me a little bit about your dad, Jason, and what he was like?
My dad was normal. You know, he was a great dad and he loved being a dad, and it showed. You know, I always talk about the gymnastics. I had a gymnastics recital, and during them, you're meant to stay really quiet and you clap at the end. My dad cheered and stood up the entire time while I was the entire place was silent, and he was like, "Go, Sarah, go, Sarah," do you know? And he was the dad that brought bananas and popsicles to our baseball game, so that if we won, we got popsicles because we did great, and if we lost, you know, and we had the bananas then if we to keep us strong, and then if we lost, the popsicles were to make us feel better, and the bananas were to get us strong for the next one. You know, he was always, always, always a present dad. He wanted to be there. He wanted to be at everything. You know, we were just speaking beforehand that he was always taking photos, and you know, he'd share photos back to Ireland to our family so they can see me and Jack grow up, because we didn't get to see them all the time. You know, and I remember him bringing Molly flowers. He was a good husband. He took care of all of us. He made sure that anytime we were going out, that tell her she looked beautiful. And he was the type of dad that just loved family.
Yeah.
Very family orientated. We all are in our family.
And that was so evident that it's almost like he put his own feelings on the back burner, or his own good instincts.
Yeah.
Because he wanted yourself and Jack to have a happy, normal childhood, because you lost your mum, Mags, when you were 12 weeks old.
Yeah.
Can you remember anything about your life in Ireland before you you moved to America? Probably not.
I remember bits and pieces.
Okay.
Do you know, I do remember my first memory is me in my cot. And I can see my mom had picked out, like my birth mom had picked out like loads of pink furniture and pink blankets and stuff. And I just remember having a picture of that in my head. And I remember our house in Ballinasloe. We lived in like a countryside, and the house was beautiful. My parents built it together. And thankfully my mom made a scrapbook of the build, and she wrote little notes in it. And it's lovely seeing there's a picture of them. My dad has his arms wrapped around my mom next to their for sale sign. And it is just a muddy patch of land, but they just look so happy. Do you know? So I know I was born into a really loving family, and I have a loving family as well.
Yeah, you said that you were born into a house full of love.
Yeah.
And I suppose with my own daughter, you know, getting sick so shortly after she was born, I always hoped that if I didn't survive, that she would have a sense of me.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe she wouldn't remember me entirely, but maybe she would have a sense of my love or what that felt like. And that has remained in you.
Yeah, definitely. Like it was actually the other day we were looking at a video that I made, and David, my earth father, as I call him, he was like, "Go back there." And he was like, "Doesn't she look like Mags right there, the spitting image of her?" And I have her mannerisms and her characteristics. Like sometimes I say stuff and they're like, "That's such a Mags thing to say."
Wow.
Do you know? So I definitely do feel, even as I get older, closer with my mom, you know, and I have a lot of her things, like I have her wedding dress and her wedding rings and stuff like that. So I do feel close to her.
So important to keep those special things, isn't it? So in your book, it's such a clear and perfectly well put together account of everything that had happened. And we go on this emotional journey with you through it. But you speak in the book about Molly Martin's coming into your life. And can you tell anyone who isn't familiar with the story how this woman came to be a part of your family?
My dad, after my mom passed away, my dad decided that he was going to get an au pair after a while, because he was still working and he had two babies. So Molly came into our life as an au pair from America. And that's when she moved in with us.
We've just said that, you know, your dad did so much for yourself and Jack in order for you guys to have a normal, happy upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the relationship started with Molly. And how soon afterwards did you guys decide that America was your next chapter?
I was around 4 at the time when we moved. I don't remember all of it, but I do remember when we got there. I remember being at the house. And, you know, it was a difficult move for my dad, I'd say, as well, because he wanted us to grow up with our cousins and family around. But Molly said she was homesick and he loved her. So he decided that we'll move and we'll be closer to her family and we can visit Ireland. But I remember the excitement of moving over. We were all excited. And Molly and my dad would, when we got into the house, they were pointing out, they were arm in arm, you know, pointing out, "Oh, we'll put the couch there and we'll put this here." And, you know, I was running around my bedroom because it was the biggest room I'd ever seen in my entire life, because it's such a big difference, especially because I was so small. The difference from the houses in Ireland and the houses in America.
Everything is bigger over
Everything
there.
Is like 10 times bigger.
Yeah.
So I was just super excited, and my dad told me I was going to get a real princess bed, you know, and he called me his little princess. So I was beaming. I was couldn't wait to start my new life there, and the weather was great as well.
Yeah, that's yeah. always a bonus, isn't it? And it was a real kind of American dream, the white yeah. picket fence, and you know, you're so extremely close to all of your family in yeah. Ireland. How do you think they felt to see you guys go?
I'd say it was hard for them to see us go. Like, we've spoken about it, you know, and it was definitely extremely difficult to see us leave. But I think, you know, they were happy that we were going on that journey as well. You know, we all were excited about it. But it was a big change, because my dad, especially with Tracy, were so close, and our families were really close as well. So I'd say that was really difficult.
Yeah. Well, your dad, he was able to transfer over to the company you worked for, but just in North Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what do you remember about those early days in America?
I remember starting, like, I was the new girl in the town, but my dad was really good at, like, putting us forward for things. You know, we were on the soccer team, we were on the baseball teams, and, you know, he was teaching them so that we didn't feel uncomfortable.
Wow.
You know, like, he joined into everything. He became friends with all the dads of my friends, and Joe Molly did the same. She became friends with the moms, and he was just right in there getting us, making sure we were making friends. Got us into a really good school. I was cheerleading. Jack was in basketball, you know, so it was really exciting. And I really liked it.
Yeah. It's only actually probably now, as, you know, looking at Pia in school, and it's a big effort to be the coach when you have a full-time job and get involved in that side yeah. of your children's school life. So yeah. it was obviously so important to your dad that you felt comfortable in this new country.
Yeah, because it wasn't just me as well. He was Jack's soccer coach and Jack's baseball coach, you know, and he helped with the basketball team. You know, it was everything that he was getting into, and they weren't all on the same times. So he would be at my training and then Jack's, you know, so he was really invested in being there, and he wanted us to make friends. He wanted us to enjoy the move.
Yeah. Tell us about your house and what your surroundings were like over there.
We had a beautiful, beautiful house, and we were living in such a nice area. There was 18-hole golf course, there was a pool, and we had the biggest, like, lovely garden, and there was a forest behind us. It was an absolute dream. You know, it was beautiful. And like I said, everything is bigger in America.
Yeah.
Everything is bigger, you know.
You think that Molly, that would have been enough for her. What was your relationship like with her? And in reading the book, wow, I just got such a sense of just the memories that you have of really tough moments with her.
You know, one day it was me that she was obsessing over, and that I was the greatest thing in the world. And then the next day it was Jack. You know, and I didn't recognize what she was doing as coercive control
mm-hmm.
until years later.
Because, you know, we probably didn't even know what that was back
then. You know,
then.
Like,
yeah.
We were talking about it, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I didn't know what was happening. My dad didn't know what was happening, and Jack didn't know what was happening. You know, I remember feeling like this is wrong, but I didn't know any different. I didn't know any different. And I loved Molly, and I trusted her as well. Jo, she was the only mother figure I had known at the time. And, you know, what mother tells their daughter that her dad killed her birth mom?
I think that was the most shocking part of reading your story. And what I read from your book is that had always been the narrative since you were a little tiny girl.
Yeah.
Molly had told you that your dad had killed your mum.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about the sort of things that she would say to you and what you thought was normal?
She told me from a very young age that my dad was a bad man, and that he was a bad dad. She told me that my dad killed my birth mom, and I knew that was a lie. Do you know, I knew that was a lie, but I I couldn't say anything. You know, I didn't know how to express that you're not telling me the truth. And I remember only a few weeks before my dad was killed that we didn't really get a lot of time on our own. And I ran up to him and I asked him on the random, how did my mom die? And he said, Sarah, I told you, you know, she died of an asthma attack. You know how she died. And I said, but really, what happened? And he looked at me so confused because he didn't know the reason why I was asking that question. You know, and I knew that my dad couldn't hurt anyone. This is the guy who used to, you know, take spiders and take them outside with a piece of paper and a cup. You know, it wasn't his nature to ever. And I want to be completely clear that I never saw my dad hit or hurt Molly ever in my entire life. And it was really difficult to listen to the defense say that my dad was abusive. I lied. And I have to live with the fact that I created that narrative. I lied in Dragonfly. I lied during my interviews. They were 3 days after my dad was killed.
And you were told what to say.
And I was told what to say. And I had been told for years what to say.
Mm.
You know, I didn't have to. I was sat down and told, you have to tell them that dad hit mom, that dad was bad. You know, the Martins went through what I had to say. And during my interview, I say, sorry, can I say that again? I said that wrong.
So in the lead up to your dad's death, can you tell me about what life was like at home during that time?
Everything had gotten really tense. Molly was spiraling, you know, a lot was happening. Molly was exploding a lot more. I speak about the time that I came down the stairs and saw Molly beating Jack, and that he looked at me and he's like, Sarah, please. And he'd never tried to get me involved before. And I ran to him and I jumped on her back and tried to pull her off him. And she grabbed me and threw me onto the floor. And she was just screaming and screaming. And then all of a sudden she just stopped and walked away like nothing had happened.
Do you think your dad knew the extent of how she was treating you guys and the things that she was saying to you?
No, but he did find out a few days or a week before he died that Molly had been telling me that he killed my birth mom.
You said in the book, several nights before his death, you watched something break inside him.
Yeah. Yeah. Molly had come up the stairs and come into my room one night, and she started screaming that my dad killed my birth mom and saying that he's going to kill me like he killed his first wife. And I don't think she knew that my dad had followed her up the stairs, because I looked out the door and my dad was standing there after she had said it. And I just saw every bit of fight drain out of him. You know, I saw him welling up. I saw the tears in his eyes, you know, and I saw him trying to come up with what he should say, you know, or what he could do. And he asked Molly to leave my room and she wouldn't leave. And he just said to me, Sarah, you know, I would never do that. And he left. And the next day, Molly had left the house. And I was so angry at both of them for bringing me into it and making me a part of the argument. And what I didn't realize was I was angry at Molly. I just wouldn't let myself be. And my dad was coming up the stairs and I heard his footsteps and I saw him and I could see his eyes were red and bloodshot and he'd been crying, you know. And I'd never seen that before. You know, no 8-year-old sees their parents cry, especially, you know, your dad is your hero. He's the strongest person in the world. And he was definitely mine, you know. And he came up the stairs and he said, Sarah, please, can I talk to you? And I remember I just ran straight to him and gave him a hug. And he just kept saying how sorry he was for everything, because I think he realized what was actually going on.
Yeah. And it's like when you say there, you could be angry at both of them.
Yeah.
So when you're angry at your dad, you can be embraced by love and have a chat and a heart to heart.
Yeah.
But you couldn't be angry at her and let her know, because then you would be punished.
Yeah. Yeah, I never got angry at Molly, ever. I couldn't, you know, because it was either I was going to be punished, and that could be anything from her not speaking to me to I'm not eating tonight, you know. Or she can take her anger out on Jack, and that would be my fault. You know, that's what it would, that's, she would make me feel like that was my fault. She would tell me it's my fault.
Yeah, and restrict food.
Yeah. If we didn't win swim meets, we didn't eat. And that's why I loved Friday nights, which I talk about, because it was always burger nights.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about burger nights. So every, when I read this, I was like, I need to do this.
Yeah, yeah. Every Friday night, my dad got off work a little bit earlier, so he was able to come home and we would turn on the barbecue out the back on our balcony, and he would fry up burgers, and he'd get the chair, and I could stand on the chair and help him flip the burgers. And, you know, it was the time where actually I was able to spend with my dad and enjoy it and not feel like I was going to get in trouble for spending time with him, you know. And he'd be singing away to himself, flipping the burgers, he'd make a salad, and we'd all sit outside and have burgers on a Friday evening. And it was the only time I got to eat like a good bit of food, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's a memory that I cherish, because all I have in that memory is happiness. Yeah. You know, I can see myself and my dad in our back garden while the sun is setting on a hot summer's evening, flipping burgers. You know, I can remember what it smells like.
They're the important memories to hold on to.
Yeah.
Tell us what your dad used to say when you walked down the stairs.
So my dad, I don't know where it came from, but he would always say, "Booga wooga wooga," and he'd do a little dance. And we had this tradition that I would jump off the stairs to him. So I got to like stair 7, which is pretty good, I must say, you know, and I would jump into his arms and he'd start spinning me around. And Jack did it too. And I've asked people in my family, nobody knows where it came from, but I ended up naming my first book, Noodle Loses Dad, a part of a Booga Wooga series, because I wanted my dad to be remembered by his, like, how happy he was. Like, he was a ray of sunshine, really, do you know? He really was. And it was just like another memory that's just happiness. That's all it is just happiness, and it's silliness. And, you know, it's like when your dad teaches you how to ride a bike or you play catch, you know, that memories that you have that are just, it's your childhood, you know, and that is locked away in my childhood memories.
Oh, I love that. And actually that makes up your DNA. Like, that becomes you and who you are and the energy that you pass on to the world.
A short break to thank Electrocell for supporting the Good Glow this season. So what do electrolytes do? Well, you don't need to be an athlete to take them. They simply help you stay hydrated by helping your body absorb and retain water, keeping you energized and refreshed. As often, essential electrolytes can be lost due to exercise, hot weather, travel and other factors. Electrocell is available in flavours like blackcurrant, lemon, raspberry and orange, and is vegan friendly, gluten free, caffeine free and GMO free. So pop into your local chemist or find even more information on electrocell.ie.
Take us back to the wedding, and obviously we're jumping back in time here, but I think it's a really important part of the book and your story. In summary, you know, what are your thoughts on their wedding and how it went down?
I actually didn't know that anything had happened at the wedding. I was in my own world. But it was tension filled, you know.
Yeah.
Family members had found out the day before that Molly was telling people that she was pen pals with my birth mom, and that my mom had asked her to take care of me and Jack and my dad. And that's obviously not true. At all. My mom never knew Molly. Molly never knew my mom. So there was a lot of untruths coming out in the days before.
And this was obviously raising red flags for everybody that loved your dad, but also your dad, who was put in probably a tough position at that point, because he probably felt like there was no going back.
Yeah, you know, my dad didn't want us to lose another mother figure, and he loved Molly. We loved Molly, you know, so he was learning these things as well as the rest of the family, because they had said it to him. But he was in love with Molly, and we were a family, and he had made commitments.
you spoke in the book about Molly's dad, Tom.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a big fan of your dad, was he?
No, no. None of the Martins were, and they were never nice to him either.
Why?
I don't know. He definitely pulled the stereotypical Irish, you know, tried to make it out like my dad was a big drinker when he just wasn't, you know, and they made it out that my dad didn't make a lot of money when he did, and he was employed. Molly wasn't. She was a swim coach. He was the reason we were living in America. He paid for the wedding. He paid for the house. He paid for the furnishings. Joe paid for Molly's car. And they made it out to me to the point where I believed it, that my dad didn't make any money. Do you know? And they just were openly not nice to my dad, making jokes about his weight or about where he's from or about, you know, where he grew up.
Yeah, like a snobbery against the being Irish.
Yeah, and my dad always chuckled it off or, you know, said, oh, you know, we're not all like that, or played off. And he would always tell me and Jack, you know, I'm proud to be Irish. You know, we're lucky. Don't listen to that now, lads. You know, he always made sure that we were proud of where we were from. And I'm absolutely proud of where I'm from.
Yeah. So a couple of days then before your dad was killed, you said something in him changed. And I guess I felt like I knew this as well before your book, that maybe he was trying to get out at this point or was making plans in secret to get yourself and Jack home to Ireland.
Yeah, definitely. Jack said he saw two suitcases the night before my dad passed away. And he asked me and Jack, did we want to go home in the car? He said, what do you guys think about moving home? And I knew something was up because I said, with Molly. And he said, I don't know yet. Do you know? And I had seen him looking at Aer Lingus flights. So I believe, and Jack also believes, that my dad was making plans to move away. And, you know, my dad had a conversation with one of his friends and he said that he needed to be on a flight before the Martins found out that he was even gone.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks volumes, that he knew he needed to be gone before they found out.
Yeah.
Before we continue with Sarah's story, Jason Corbett was found beaten to death in his own bedroom on August 2nd, 2015, with a baseball bat and a brick, which was on Molly's nightstand. Jason had been making plans to return to Ireland with his children. But long before that, Molly had visited a divorce lawyer in the weeks after she married Jason. Her question, what custody rights she had to the children. The evening before Jason's death, Molly's parents, Tom and Sharon, arrived at their daughter and Jason's home at 8:30 p.m. Tom claims he was woken later that night. He says Jason and Molly were rowing and that he had jumped to her defence with a metal baseball bat. That night, Jason suffered such horrific injuries that experts could not count the number of times he had been hit. Hours later, Molly told the children that she had gotten into a fight with Jason and that she pushed him and that he hit his head and died. Jason had appointed his sister Tracy and her husband David to become guardians of Sarah and Jack should anything happen to him. However, Sarah and Jack were left in the care of the Martins in the days and weeks after Jason's death. This is when the children were interviewed by social workers, and Jack and Sarah say they told lies about their dad to protect Molly. Their statements were later retracted. Tracy was finally given access to the children and they moved back to Ireland. Last year, the Martins accepted a plea deal in which they admitted to voluntary manslaughter. That was a week before a new trial on charges of second-degree murder had been due to begin. They had been found guilty in the original trial when Molly was sentenced to 20 years and her dad, Tom, was given a 25-year term. That verdict was overturned on appeal in 2021. They have never denied killing Jason, but they say they acted in self-defence. They are now free after serving 4 years and 3 months in jail.
It was the first time I cried in the book, and it's very early in the book. You speak about meeting the man who carried you down the stairs that night.
Yeah.
what can you tell us about that night that you feel comfortable? If you don't feel comfortable, we'll move on. But is there anything that you would like to share about that night?
I do remember everything about that night because we've had to, you know, say it to loads of different, you know, yeah, officials. But I would like to say that I was shielded from a lot of what have happened. You know, I was woken up by a police officer, Corporal Clay Dagenhart, and he told me that I had two options, that I could walk backwards down the stairs or I could be carried down the stairs. And I said I needed to be carried down the stairs. And we got out to the landing and I saw Jack with another police officer. And I could hear, it was so loud in our house, I could hear the fuzzing of all of the walkie-talkies. I could hear boots on the floors, people talking downstairs, but I couldn't understand what they were saying. But I was picked up and he put my head in the nape of his neck and held it. And he was holding my head there. I couldn't move it.
Okay.
And when we got near the bottom of the stairs, everything went silent. All the walkie-talkies stopped. All of the walking around stopped. People stopped talking. And it was like the entire world just froze. And all I could hear was the two police officers' feet walking. That was it. And then as soon as we got towards the basement door, it all started again.
Wow.
Do you know, and we went downstairs and Sharon was sitting up in bed, reading a book with her nightlight on.
So this is the person who, I suppose, in inverted commas, was supposed to be your granny.
Yeah.
What did the police officer say when he woke you up? Do you remember? What did you know why you were being carried downstairs?
No. He just told me I had two options. I think he might have introduced himself. He was so nice. I wasn't, like, obviously I was confused, mm-hmm, but I wasn't terrified. You know, I felt, yeah, safe. I knew he was a police officer. And when I met him, because he came up to me, this is when I met him only in, like, about 2 years ago. He came up to me and he said, "I don't know if you remember me." And I was looking at him and I just knew I knew him. And I've always, Tracy said it so many times, I've always said how lucky I was and I've always spoke about the police officer who brought me down the stairs. And he said to me, "I carried you down the stairs that night," and we both just started crying.
Wow, what a special person.
Yeah, and his wife had been following the story and he couldn't, because if he had to give evidence, he couldn't. But he said he was really happy to meet me and we just kept talking to each other and I kept crying. And I, you know, that's someone who really impacted my life in a positive way and made me feel safe in probably one of the scariest nights of my entire life.
Yeah. And it's such a stark contrast to the reception you got when you were brought into the basement to Sharon,
yeah,
Tom's wife,
yeah,
who is Molly's mother. So what was she doing in the room?
She was just reading. The three dogs were inside the room running around and she was just reading. She didn't act like anything was wrong. She didn't seem worried. She didn't even ask the police officer what was going on. You know, Jack said, "Where's my mom and dad?" And the police officers told us we just need to stay here for a while. And Sharon told us just listen to the police officers and she kept reading her book. That's one of the reasons why I didn't think anything had happened. I thought maybe, you know, we got broken into, or, you know, maybe someone got broken arm, you know. And like, I had no idea about what was going on. And Sharon stayed like that always. She never seemed bothered.
Never cared for you or embraced you or showed you any love.
No, I remember she was the type of person that really say how you feel, say what you mean, you know, don't sugarcoat things. And I remember when I was about, I think I was like five, I ran in to her house to show her my new dress and she told me that I looked fat in it. So she was never warm. She was always very cold.
I have to say that was really surprising to me when I read the book, because you just presume that you were taken care of in some way around that time after losing the most important person in your life.
No, I never got asked, was I okay? When I asked Molly about my dad, she told me to get over it and gave out to me.
Mm.
And And we went to Bobby's house. His wife had family from Puerto Rico over.
Bobby is Molly's brother.
She had family from Puerto Rico, and they were all, you know, going into the pool, watching movies, having barbecues, and all of the Martins acted like nothing happened.
And this was in the days after what happened to your dad. So you found out later that day that your dad had died.
Yeah.
And you guys were devastated, but you were bundled into the back of a car and driven to somebody's, Molly's brother's house, where everybody in the house just acted normally. Nobody was comforting you guys. Yeah. No one was asking you if you were okay.
Yeah.
I mean, how on earth can that happen? It's just, it breaks my heart into a million pieces to think of you kids over there. And I'm sure for Tracy and all of your dad's family, it's just devastating to hear that you could lose the most important person in your life and nobody is comforting you.
Nobody asked me, was like, okay, until I was put into the care of Tracy and David. I spent most of my time on my own. In the treehouse, in Bobby's house. And Jack found a cornfield and would just sit there for hours. You know, and we didn't get to have a close relationship because Molly wouldn't let us be siblings. She wouldn't let us spend time together. So I couldn't even talk to Jack about it because we weren't close and we didn't have that type of relationship. You know, and nobody even, you know, gave us a hug. How are you doing? You know, Molly acted like she got a new lease of life. She was so happy all the time, smiling. She started teaching Bobby's toddler how to swim in their pool.
So Molly, do you think that her behaviour changed then in those couple of weeks that you were with her?
Absolutely. She acted like she didn't have a care in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and it was almost as if my dad didn't even ever exist. It's like his name was never brought up. And if me and Jack ever brought my dad up, we were punished. Do you know? So we just didn't talk. Jack didn't speak to anyone.
Could you talk to each other? Did you feel closer to him in that time or?
No.
No.
You know, I remember Molly coming into my room when me and Jack were playing together and screaming at us and telling Jack to go back to his room and that we weren't allowed to spend time together. You know, we didn't get to have a close relationship. She pitted us against each other for years to the point where I thought if I talk to him, he's going to tell Molly, and he probably thought the exact same thing. So we didn't talk, and Jack didn't speak to anyone. He played with the dogs, or he was sitting in a cornfield in the middle of nowhere on his own.
And were Tom and Sharon around at this point?
Yes, the entire family was there.
Okay.
Mike Ernest, Molly's uncle, was there with his wife, and all of her brothers were there. Her parents were there. No one questioned where we were gone. It was like my dad didn't exist, and it was almost like we didn't either.
Yeah, it's like if you accidentally killed somebody or killed somebody in self-defense, you think you would be absolutely traumatized after that and need comfort and not just continue your life as normal.
I know Molly was looking at apartments for us to move into. We went school shopping with her uncle. He brought us to Walmart and started getting us pencils and school bags. Because we were meant to start school. Do you know, we went to the beach. Do you know, they took us on a mini holiday and acted like nothing.
And your house was forensically cleaned.
Oh, yeah.
And all traces of your dad disappeared, wedding ring gone, everything.
Yeah. And, do you know, they were all put into, I think Tracy and David got it sorted out, that my dad's stuff would be put in a storage unit. And about 4 years ago, we were going over for a pretrial hearing before we found out about the plea deal. And we rang to go in. We wanted to go and look through his stuff and pick out the things that we were going to keep. And we were in America, and David rang the storage unit, and they told us that the Martins had not paid, or someone hadn't paid, and they had sold everything.
Wow. And even down to Tom and Sharon driving your dad's car, like, that must have been just so awful for you to see. What was Molly's relationship like with her parents?
It was like she was extremely close with her mom.
Okay.
Do you know, her mom used to send her half birthday cakes and cards. Extremely close with her
mom. 6 months after her birthday, she got a celebration that she was 33 and a half.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And they spoke on the phone every day. They visited all the time, you know, and she was close to her dad as well. They had, I don't really know how to describe their relationship. You know, it was kind of like sometimes they were close and other times they weren't. But she was extremely close to her parents and her brothers as well. But it was just, me and Jack weren't a part of that family, you know. We weren't a part of the Martins family. And it was clear to us.
Yeah. But, and yet she so desperately wanted you.
Yeah.
As her children.
Yeah.
And it's all down to exactly what you said at the start. And it was just such an aha moment when you said it's control. It's all just control.
Yeah.
And Tom, as a former FBI agent, was probably very stoic.
Like, out of the Martins, he did try with me to be, you know, grandfatherly sometimes. But at the same time, like, when I stayed in their house, I slept in the basement. And they had these big posters of the Kiss band, which was absolutely terrifying for a 4 or 5 year old, 6 year old. And, you know, they were never warm. Like, you know, I know what having grandparents are like because I have grandparents in Ireland. And, you know, my nanny used to make me the best cup of tea in the world.
Yeah.
Do you know? And my grandfather used to let me pick apples from his tree. And he showed me how to plant things and the right things to put in the soil. You know, I know what grandparents are like, and it wasn't that.
Yeah, all those little moments we take for granted. So tell us about Tracy and David and what it was like when they came to America and that transition period for you.
I remember the first time I saw Tracy and David. We had been brought to, I forget what the name of the place, but we'd been brought to this place, and Tracy and David walked in. And I remember I was holding baby doll and Tracy crouched down next to me and she said, "Can I give you a hug, love?" And she gave, I gave her a hug, and I just, it felt like my dad was hugging me, you know.
Yeah.
And her accent was like my dad's, you know, and it was the first time she asked me, "Was I okay? How are you doing?" Nobody had asked me that. And it was the same for Jack. And when we went back to their hotel, they'd gotten this this huge hotel room so that we felt comfortable, you know, that we had our own space.
Mm-hmm.
And we slept for 14 hours, 16 hours, I think, you know. And Tracy and David had to come in and wake us up because they thought that there was something wrong with us. But looking back on it, I know I just felt safe, that I could sleep through the night. I felt I was with family. I was with people who, like, they flew across the world for me to give me a hug,
mm-hmm.
to ask me, was I okay? Do you know, nobody else had done that for me other than my dad.
Wow. And obviously when she hugged you, it felt like home a little bit.
Yeah, it did, definitely.
And I've had the pleasure of meeting Tracy a few times and yourself. You're so alike.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely a mini me, I think, you know. And we're really close to the point where sometimes mom is like, I call her my mom. She's like, "Sarah, you shouldn't tell me that. You know, like, don't tell me. I don't need to know, you know." And like, even last night we were having like real girl chats and she was like, "Sarah, I didn't need to know that, you know." But like, I feel, I'm lucky that I have such a close relationship. And you know, I'm also lucky that we're the same shoe size, so I can take all of her shoes.
Nice.
But definitely, as soon as I walked into the house in Limerick, there was a smell. And I don't know what it was. And sometimes I catch a wind of it and it's just home, you know. And it was the same with Adam and Dean, you know, and Kelly as well, Dean's wife. As soon as I walked in the front door, I was their sister.
Yeah.
You know, and when Tracy and David had to fly over for all of the hearings, the trial, everything, Dean and his partner at the time, his now his wife, minded us, took care of us. You know, they stepped in as mom and dad, you know, cooked us dinner, made sure we got to all training, made sure we did everything, you know. And we had that bond. And I'm extremely lucky that there was no, like, "Oh, they're moving in with us." It was straight away, it was like, "You're a part of, this is a part of our gang now," do you know?
Wow.
And I'm extremely close to my brothers, you know, and I'm so lucky I'm an aunt now as well. You know, Dean has had a baby, Max, and I think it just brings so much joy into the family. And we're really close, all of us. Joe, yeah. We have our dinners and we talk for hours and hours and hours. And each of my brothers is something else for me, you know? Like, Dean is my role model, you know, 100%. Need advice, he's going to tell me what I need to hear,
yeah,
not what I want to hear. Do you know, Adam's like my buddy, you know, he's like my go-to guy if I need to just rant about
my
something.
My go-to guy, I love that.
He is my go-to guy. It was actually the night before last, I was sitting on our island in our kitchen, and two of us were talking for like 2 hours, just wow. About nothing, you know, and just rambling on. And me and Jack have been able, luckily, to build up our relationship and our trust with each other, which is lovely. And he's also now getting used to the fact that we have similar friends. So he's dealing with that in a lovely way. You know, he's not a fan, but we've been able to work through our differences and our traumas. So we've been able to have conversations that we couldn't have had before.
Yeah.
So it's extremely important to me. And I wouldn't have that without Tracy and David. I wouldn't be where I am. I wouldn't be the person that I am today without them. I've been through a lot of trauma, but when it comes to outcomes, I am extremely lucky, and I've seen it. You know, I've seen people who've gone through trauma and don't have the resources that yeah. I had, didn't have the family that just were like, yeah, move in with us.
I know.
Do you know, they put me into counseling like 2 weeks after I came back, and Tracy decided that I couldn't say things at the beginning. I couldn't. I could write them down, but I couldn't say my experience. I couldn't say what had happened to me. So Tracy began to say, okay, love, just write it down on a piece of paper, leave it on my pillow. And because the boys were all into the rugby and everything, they'd leave the house for training and stuff. So we'd sit down and have time, just the two of us. I think it was the way how I expressed myself for years. I only stopped doing it in recent years, that I was able to sit down and speak to someone who genuinely cared, genuinely was like, I want you to be the best person that you can be, you know. And my mom is here today, you know she's my biggest supporter.
Yeah, I love her.
You know, I wouldn't be where I am today without her. She is absolutely my best friend in the world, but I really wouldn't be here without Tracy and David.
It's like she did everything that your dad would have done.
Yeah.
And that's come straight from the heart.
Yeah.
The last time that you saw Molly as a child, did she ever say goodbye to you or...
We saw her at the back of the courtroom, and
when was this?
This was in 2015.
2015, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And before we went back to Ireland, and they filmed it, and I gave her a photograph, like I drew a picture, and then she used that against me and posted it online. You know, she said goodbye and showed me pictures of us together. So what was meant to be, you know, a goodbye to someone who had been your mother figure for years, she ended up using against me and posting it all over social media for everyone to see. And that was devastating for me because it was kind of one of the first times that I realized she didn't love me unconditionally. Like, she used the love that me and Jack had for her to get a lesser charge.
Oh my God. Because I'd also read, and it's in your book too, that she tried to contact people, you know, when you guys came back to Ireland.
Yeah. She friend requested and tried to contact people in my class. A girl, one of my friends sitting next to me in fifth class, tried to contact her. You know, tried to contact Jack's friends, tried to fly a plane over our school. And thankfully, the people in Shannon Airport said no.
Why would she do that?
It was her birthday. So she wanted to say happy birthday, Jack and Sarah, and she wanted to put her number on it so that we could call her.
So why do you think she was trying to get in touch with you? Do you think she was trying to help herself and her own case?
Yes.
in at that point, yeah.
Absolutely. Do you know, she was just gonna use that against us, you know. And unfortunately she did that to Jack. And it's just like, when I look back on it and I think about how young I was, that somebody that was that I trusted her, you know, could do that. It's just, I try and imagine it as if it was another kid so that I can look at it. And I couldn't imagine doing that to somebody.
No, awful. you finally got to use your voice in court, and your book is kind of centered around your victim impact statement.
Yeah.
And it was so beautifully written, and like the rest of your book, and you actually, it's here in full in your book, and you read it out on your audiobook, which must have been a very difficult thing for you to do. But how did you feel after you got to speak in a courtroom with the Martins, and they could hear from you how much this has impacted your life?
I felt empowered watching, because I was the last person to speak, and I felt empowered while I was doing it, because we had given photos of my dad to the judge, because I wanted him to see my dad, because he'd only seen crime scene photos. It was important that he saw this was someone's dad, this was someone's brother, someone's son, someone's husband, do you know? And I felt empowered in the moment, but straight after we gave our victim impact statements, the judge basically said that they wouldn't affect his decision, and I didn't know that. Now, it's known. I didn't know that. I thought it was meant to have an impact, and I understand it gives victims a say, but I wanted to give evidence. My dad didn't get a character witness. You know, the Martins, Molly and Tom, who were both alive and sitting there, who were well capable of speaking for themselves, had character witnesses. My dad had nobody. And I asked the prosecution, could I do it? Do you know, and I asked, could I speak? Because my dad is dead. He can't speak up for himself. He has no voice. The Martins silenced him. They tried to silence me and Jack. They tried to silence Tracy and David, but through the book, I've been able to get my voice back, you know, and I want people to know that my dad was just a genuine, loving dad and person.
Yeah, it certainly comes across. But now you get to, it's your turn now to show the world.
I've been extremely lucky with the support in Ireland, in Limerick and across America. I've been extremely lucky with the amount of people that have reached out to say, we can, if you need anything, let us know. It made me feel very special, and I was overwhelmed, you know, and that's just continued. You know, I like have had people reach out to me and say that, you know, they connected with me and they, you know, they're proud of me. People that I don't even know. And I don't think people understand how much that means and how the support I've gotten has given me the confidence to talk.
Yeah, I love that. I'll ask this question. I know the answer, obviously, but do you think justice was served in the sentences they received? They're out of prison now.
No, definitely not. I don't think any time would have been enough.
Okay.
But definitely not 4.5 years, you know.
Do you think that she still watches things that you do, or do you think about that?
Not really. What I think about is I want people to read this book, and I want people to know my story, because I don't want it happening again.
Okay.
And I don't want another family to be torn apart like mine was. And I know it's important to Jack as well that we don't want this happening again.
What do you think that your dad would want people to know?
I think that he would want to know about him and my birth mom.
Okay.
You know, I think that scrapbook I spoke about earlier really shows the love that they had. You know, they were a happy young couple. Just their family was just complete. You know, they just built their own home. They were both in good jobs. I think my dad would want to know that he was loved and did love, you know. And I want people to know that my dad was loved and he is loved by me and my family.
Yeah. And they are together again, taken far too soon, but nonetheless together.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite memory with your dad? I know we spoke about the burgers, but is there anything else maybe that sticks out?
I think my favourite memory was walking on the beach in Spanish Point. It is where my love of horses came from. It was a really rainy day and nobody wanted to go for a walk, but my dad was like, who wants to go? So I took the opportunity to spend the time with my dad on my own. And it's probably the best decision I ever made. And I remember we were walking and I was obsessed with The Little Mermaid. So I thought seaweed was Ursula. And if I got stuck in it, I couldn't get out, you know, if I stepped in the seaweed. And my dad would pick me up and swoop me around. You know, he was the only person that could save me from the seaweed. And we saw these big giant horses running towards us. And obviously my dad was like, come here to me, trying to make sure I didn't get trampled. But I was in awe. And I remember my dad picked me up and we were looking at the jockeys and these beautiful, beautiful horses. And I was like, Dad, I want to do that. And he said, okay, Sarah, you know, I was like, no, I want to do that. And the next Christmas, he got me horse riding boots and a helmet. And I was actually really lucky that he was so cautious about getting me a big size boot so that I'd fit into them, that I actually didn't fit into them until I was 12. So I got to have that gift that I got for Christmas from my dad after he'd passed away.
Wow. Just what was coming up for me there is there's so many walks and adventures that we don't go on because it's raining.
Yeah.
But we should just go on them anyway. Is this closure now for you, do you think?
Yeah. I've said it a few times that I've actually cried a lot less since I wrote the book and since I've writing it, rewriting, editing, you know, doing the audiobook, I've actually got to take all of the little funnels of trauma that I had and put them together and look at it as this happened, all of this happened. And it's given me a chance to come to terms with what happened to me, what happened to Jack, what happened to my dad, and put it to bed. Mm-hmm. You know, I do have trauma. I do have bad days and I will always have a bad day. You know, I've been through a lot, but at the same time, I've had such good things happen in my life. So I will always live with the trauma that happened and the grief. And I'll always miss my dad and miss my mom. But at the same time, it is the past.
Yeah.
You know, I want to live my life the way that my dad would have wanted to see me live my life and the way my mom would have wanted to see me live my life.
One of the greatest things that are the most freeing things I've heard has been in the last 6 months. It's from Dr. Brian Penny, who said, I was watching him speak and he said, you know what, I think we're all so obsessed with trying to cure our trauma or let it go or get over it. He said, my trauma is always going to be with me. It's always going to be a part of who I am.
Yeah.
And it's okay for me to carry it because it actually is going to make me a better person. It's going to bring me to great places. And when he said that, I was like, God, I've been so focused on trying to heal my trauma that actually he gave me permission to carry it a little bit along the way. And that's exactly what you've said. Yeah. You're so wise.
Thank you. But it's acknowledging like this did happen to me. You know, I can't make it go away. Mm. It's always going to be there. But at the same time, what am I going to do about it? It was actually at your show at Christmas time. I can't remember who said it, but it was at the primary and secondary reactions.
Yes, Brian Penny.
Yeah, it was Brian. So he said that, and it always hit me, even just on little things, that, you know, something happens to you is the primary, but what you do about it, you can control. You can control that. That's on you. So your reaction is your responsibility. And literally, same as you, the last 6 months, I've just been able to calm down about things because I think, what am I going to do about this? If I react this way, is it going to be negative? Is there a point in reacting like that? No. Do you know? And it's helped me so much to just realize things and put things in perspective. You know, do I get angry at this? Is that going to make my day better? No. Is it that big of a deal? No. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It really has helped me to just understand that I have control, you know, and I have a voice. You know, it was really important and it was very inspiring.
Oh,
all of your guests are always inspiring, just like you.
Jamie's like, are we doing another Christmas show? I'm like, no, I'm going to feel like I have to because I want to see you guys again.
It's a tradition. Every year we get so excited coming up to it. We do it every year now. We stay in a lovely hotel, we stay overnight, we get all dolled up. Joe, we go, we get to see your show, we get to meet you, of course, and get to say hi. And it's so fun. Oh, we love it.
But thank you for being a part of it, because when I'm on stage, knowing that there's people like you in the audience helps me so much. You know, the last 5 minutes of this podcast, I think everything that you've said is going to help a lot of people maybe drop their shoulders a little bit and stop being so hard on themselves. And your book, A Time for Truth, it's out now. I recommend everyone run to the shops to get it and read your story, because we have waited so many years to hear it, Sarah, and it's told so beautifully, so courageously, so bravely.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It means a lot to me, and I'm really happy that you had me on the show. I've been excited for this.
This is a dream for me, so thank you.
I'm like, I didn't bring any tissues.
Oh my god, you're amazing!
Thank you.
Like,
that's
how we might be.
Yeah,
lovely.
Oh, I just thought it would be so nice to leave that moment when we finished recording the podcast in the episode, because there was so much love in the room as we recorded this episode. Tracy was there, Elaine from Hachette, Shane from Collaborative Studios, and there was so much love and support around Sarah. And that really is the essence of who she is and the energy around her at the moment. It's a really special time for her. So I hope that you will go and buy the book and support her. Thank you so much to you for tuning in. I have left Sarah's Instagram in the show notes if you'd like to send her a message. You know, on days like this, it's an absolute privilege to do what I do. And thank you so much for listening.